Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Walking the Floor. We are back. That's right, every 2 weeks, people. We're sticking to that schedule. Came back a couple weeks ago, and here we are again, and we'll be back in a couple weeks from today. I am, as always, your host, Mr. Chris Shiflett. And today, we have a truly unbelievable, star-studded podcast, because on today's episode, I'm interviewing Mr. Brad Paisley, country living legend, ripper, maybe the most ripping country guitar player in the world right now. Brad Paisley on Walking the Floor today. And you know, I want to let you know that Brad was so gracious when I sat down with him at Sonos World Headquarters back in July last summer. And he talked to me for so long. He's such a cool dude to interview that I'm actually breaking this interview up into two parts. So there'll be part one today and part two in a couple of weeks. So if you like what you hear today, make sure that you tune back in a couple weeks to hear the rest of it. And not only do we have Mr. Paisley, but with me in the studio today is none other than my good buddy, lifelong friend, and co-guitar player in the Dead Peasants, Mr. Luke Tierney.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Luke. What's happening, man?
Not much.
Dude, where are the Dead Peasants? What'd you do to our band?
Well, you were gallivanting around the world. I killed most of them.
Well, I know we all want to kill Derek, but no one's going to blame you for that, but come on.
No, I don't know. I can't speak for any of them.
Yeah,
for myself.
The day that I interviewed Brad Paisley was the last Dead Peasants gig, I think. And it was like back in July of last summer, man.
That makes me sad.
Basically, since that day, pretty much every week I've been going, God, I really got to edit that interview, man. Really got to get that up there. And then, like, you know, whatever it's been, 9 or 10 months or however long it's been has gone by, but it's kind of flown by. Like, I honestly didn't realize until I went back and looked at the date how long it's been since I've done this podcast or since we've done anything.
Yeah.
But it's like flown by. I mean, it's, you know, it's been, there's been like busy Foo Fighter stuff.
Many arenas got played.
Many, that's right. It's hard to cut your podcast up when you're in Australia playing in stadiums. You know, the interview has been getting like kind of dusty. Like I went and looked. I was like, is Brad Paisley even like, is he still doing that TV show? Like, I haven't been paying attention.
Oh, right.
But you know what I mean? Like, I got to get this thing out there before it's like a vintage, you know, like
right.
Walk down memory lane. Now, normally I do a little preamble on who the guest is, but I'm assuming nobody out there in podcast land in the internet needs me to explain who Brad Paisley is, right?
Not the president, because he's the president's country, what did you call him?
Yeah, he's President Obama's go-to country singer.
Because every president needs one of those.
Exactly. Well, you got to have one. You know, Buck yeah. Owens was that for, you know, whoever, Richard Nixon. And, yeah. You know, I think Merle Haggard played and when Reagan was in, and, you know.
Yeah.
So he's the current guy. As a matter of fact, we talk about that in the interview, that he got to ride on Air Force One all the way to Afghanistan with the president to go play for the troops and then came all the way back.
I wonder who was more stoked to be on that plane with the other in that situation.
I'm going to guess it was Mr. Paisley.
Yeah, probably.
Well, and I asked him that in the interview. You'll hear it. It's like, I said, like, there's got to be a point when you're on a flight for that long with the president of the United States where, like, the politician veneer comes down. And,
right.
And you're just a couple of dudes
right.
sitting there talking about whatever you're, you know, whatever common ground they must have.
I wonder how deep Obama's country knowledge is.
Probably not. I bet it goes about as deep as Brad Paisley. Which is great because he was on the plane.
Right.
So they could talk about that
all
day. Yeah. I know what you do, man.
If Brad Paisley retires as Obama's country guy, can you slip in there? Is that a doable thing, you think?
You know, I'm totally up for applying for that position or with whoever the next guy in office is.
Right.
And pretty much any president of the United States, I will gladly submit our band's demo
as
to be the go-to
country act
for that term. Happy to do it. You know, I was thinking about the gig that we played back in July. And at the interview, Brad said, like, hey, man, if you want me to get up and pick a tune with you guys, you know, let me know. And so later on that night, I brought the set list over to him. And I was like, here's our set list, you know, if you want to any of these songs. And he, without even looking at it, he just goes, yeah, I know all your songs.
Quit bothering me with your little list.
Yeah, I don't need your list. I was like, damn, that is a confident shredder right yeah. there. Like, I don't think I could do that with, even if I knew the band's whole set, like, I wouldn't just be like, yeah, any of them.
Yeah.
You tell me. What? I got it. Well, so later at the gig, when he did come up, I handed him my guitar and picked up a guitar, an acoustic guitar that was not plugged in, and pretty much left you holding the bag, having to go toe-to-toe with Brad Paisley, back and forth, you know, throwing licks around.
Just me, my little handful of Ace Frehley licks, and my guitar, staring at Brad Paisley.
That's right.
With your guitar.
With his giant bag of Don Rich leads.
Yeah.
I think we made him uncomfortable with the key we played the song. But we played that Waylon Jennings song. Sure Hank done it this way.
He deemed that a chick key.
Yeah, which I'd never heard. I didn't know that that's what it was.
He can take that up with Waylon, because that's what key that song is in.
Right, exactly.
As intimidating as that was, it was actually like, it was more comfortable to be up there with him than have him staring at me while playing.
Yeah, exactly. It was epic. That was an epic night. And what a cool dude for you, for doing the interview and for coming up and playing with
him.
I really hope we get to do that again. All right, let's get to it. So without further ado, let's talk to Mr. Brad Paisley about being Obama's go-to country singer. He gives me a very great, just an amazing, like, country music history of guitar rippers that makes me want to go explore my Spotify account, and I think we pick it up where he's talking about living out here in California and getting attacked by a shark, which didn't happen, but could happen. All right, here we go. Brad Paisley, Walking the Floor.
Yeah, so we moved sort of outside LA, and we, you know, we drive, you know, up the beach a little bit to our house, and I just got to be near the water if I'm going to be out right. here, because I got to know, it's otherwise you might as well be inland, you know. I right. want to know the ocean's there.
Sure.
And then because
are you an ocean convert now?
I love it, yeah, but yeah. I don't surf or anything, but right. I love
not the, yet,
not yet. I mean, it's probably I get over a little fear of shark, I'll be all right, you know.
Yeah.
But
if we keep having these shark attacks, I don't know.
You see that when you watch Soul Surfer, it'll, you know, as a guitar player, no thanks.
Right.
It's like, well, one arm, I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, did you hear about that thing that just happened down in Manhattan Beach? It was like somebody hooked a great white and a group of swimmers just happened to go.
They
it's like,
pulled
oh,
it
come
right
on.
By,
really?
They pulled it right by the swimmers?
Yeah. It's like right as my son's in junior lifeguards. I'm like, I don't need to hear that.
I imagine it's way less likely than lightning striking, but...
Oh, you'd have to be amazingly unlucky.
Or in the water a lot.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, that's... I always think that way about airplane crashes, too. Like, it's, you know, it's so unlikely, but I'm like, but I'm on planes all the time. Like, my...
Yeah, but I still...
The percentage has to go way up.
But there's also, with airplane crashes, it's sort of like everybody all over America can be doing it. The possibility of a shark attack, you have to be on the edge of the nation.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like it doesn't, no shark attacks in Kansas.
Speaking of airplane rides, and I'm sure that you're incredibly sick of talking about this, but you have to tell me a little bit about your 13-hour ride to Afghanistan with the president playing poker. Is that true? Is that how that went down?
So who told you that?
I have not ever
actually talked about that.
Oh,
part.
For real?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Because
I imagine. I mean, that's what I heard, and I hear something like that. I go, well, if you're hanging out with the president of the United States for that long, you have to at some point.
Well, that's 13,
break through.
13 on the way over. It was 16 back.
Oh, really?
I slept twice on there. Yeah.
So you must have gotten through like the politician veneer at some point.
Well,
that's the
thing. I've played for him a bunch. For some reason, I became like the country act that he goes to.
Right.
It's like, and also, you know, he was very kind to me in his first year. And I wrote a song about his election based on sort of racial progress called Welcome to the Future mm-hmm. that was a number one record in our format. And it was a sort of, for me, it went way beyond politics when he was elected. It was like, oh my goodness. I mean, you know, and I, you know, growing up like we all did, I never imagined in my lifetime that we would see a, you know, a black president. And that was very inspiring to me, just purely not politically. And then when I wrote that song, it was so weird that right away we got this White House invitation to come do country music at the White House in the East Room. So we did that, and that was the first ever performance of that song for me, was sitting playing 10 feet from him.
God, that's heavy.
It was heavy. And I started crying after it was over, just because to be able to deliver that message to his family and saying, you know, hey, look, you know, I just like the idea that time is healing the racial tears in our society. And, you know, and then after that, I think they started to just basically say, you know, what else can he play? Right. So it's like they had me do the 4th of July concert. I think you guys have done that.
We did that. Yeah, it was amazing.
It's a blast.
Best 4th of July I've ever spent.
Yeah, because you're talking about the lawn is full of military people.
Yep.
At the White House, and you're playing for them, saying thank you.
Yeah,
and it's the best ever set.
It's the best view you've ever had for, the best for stage a fireworks set. Show. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and here's the deal: they said, "Can you end with Welcome to the Future?" I said, "Sure." And they said, "We'll try to end at about 9, so that, or I think it was 9 or 9:30. You had to, you know, whatever time that was. They said because the fireworks are starting at 9:30,
so they're not going
to try to hit
for
your
it.
Last note around then. Well, I was in the last verse, which was like this kid I went to high school with, where they burned a cross. They actually didn't do this, but the verse is written about burning a cross in a guy's lawn for having asked out the homecoming queen and stuff. And I'm in that, and it's like I thought about him today and these words, and hey, glory, glory, hallelujah, welcome to the future. And as I'm singing that, you see just that was all going. So that was our second one. And then
it's hard not to get choked up in a moment like that.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then we did, I've done Kennedy Center things before, which is always with your boss. He's at every Kennedy Center event.
Yeah, I know. He's got some kind of in over there.
So do I. It's funny. He and I both said we're on the Kennedy Center circuit.
You right. Know,
it's like
right.
we're on the Rolodex of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we did, you know, his inaugural ball. I was the only country singer they asked. And then, so it's just like instantly. I don't know what it is. They just, I guess I'm in some way his go-to country singer. And about a month before this event that you're talking about with Afghanistan and Air Force One, his chief of staff took me aside at an event and said, we might be calling you. And I said, what about? And he said, the president wants to go to Afghanistan and thank the troops one more time, and he wants to take you to play for him. And I'm like, okay, I'm going.
Yeah,
of course, that's so important. So, so it did. It came to pass. And the next thing you know, I'm standing on that airplane as it takes off. And I mean standing, you know, as it takes off.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, standing.
Yeah, because you don't have to sit down.
Yeah, it's
if
sort
you
of
don't
like
want they, to, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's like I was like, should we buckle up? They're like, you can. Yeah.
That's just something we tell the rest of the country. You're fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We know these pilots really well, and we really trust these mechanics.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing.
I mean, outside of how surreal that must have been to, you know, to travel over there and be in close quarters with the president and hang out with him. When you're over there doing a gig like that, I mean, I gotta assume that's got to be at the top of
it is.
List of your craziest gigs of all time.
Like
Do you get to meet some of the soldiers over there?
That was the most important thing about it to me. It was that I got to look them in the eye, and hopefully they'll be coming home soon because they've been there long enough. And we're not, you know, I don't know what else there is to gain from us being there, but the, you know, to be able to say thank you. And I went around that room and shook every hand I could and said thank you. And then you got the things. You've done things like this where they hand you the photo. Like, there's a photo right here. I accidentally brought my computer bag. It was in the car, and I was like, oh, you know what? I better bring this in. But look at this. This says it all. Guy hands me this. Doesn't have a name on the back. He just hands me that. And I'm like, oh, that's a beautiful family.
Oh, nice.
And I'm like,
sweet.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm like, thanks. And I give it back to him. He's like, no, just keep it for me. Really? He's like, yeah, keep it for me. And what's he saying?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah, yeah.
And I said, how old are they? He's like, well, he's 9 months. And I was like, how long have you been here? He said, I've been here about 6. So he's, you know, the kid's 3 months old and he's been over there 6 now. Months of the first.
I mean, what do you say to a guy like that?
Thank you.
Right.
You're a hero. But being able to do that and, you know, and look them in the eye, I mean, I can't even. Because for me, it's so beyond any of the politics.
Oh, yeah. You get. The politics goes out the window.
It's so nasty today, too. I mean, you know, you can imagine. It's like you almost get grief for doing. Luckily, in this case, this is a really good example of one of the few times I barely saw anybody upset that I did this. You know, which is nice. But you're always sort of making 50% of the people mad if you have anything to do with any politician whatsoever.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's way beyond that for me. It's about patriotism and saying thank you to these guys that fight.
Right.
And the rest of us surf.
Yeah. If we're lucky.
Yeah, if we're lucky.
If we're not getting eaten. I mean, that's pretty wild. That's a pretty long way to go for a guy from a really small town
in
West Virginia. I mean, do you sit there and reflect on that? Like, what, growing up in the town, what was it, Glendale?
Mm-hmm. 1,200 people.
What's the economic prospects for most people growing up in Glendale, West Virginia? You know, I don't know West Virginia at all. So when I hear Virginia, I think coal mining or something.
It is. You know what I mean? We're on the western side of the state, so we are on the Ohio River. I was 500 yards from the Ohio River growing up, and that was your entertainment source. You know, everything revolved around that.
Right.
You know, for kids, it was like when you were old enough, it's like that's a good place to go if you want to build a bonfire or park or do whatever you want, you know, whatever kids do to get away from their parents. And when I was a kid, though, my earliest and fondest memories are fishing with my grandpa and my dad. But your prospects are coal mining. There's a lot of chemical plants up and down that river. I think PPG is there, and DuPont, which whatever it's called now, is down the way. And then local things, or you leave. And you know, it's like I think houses, you know, you could probably get a pretty nice house for $50,000
right
in that area.
Well, I imagine like a kid carrying around his guitar with dreams of, you know, stardom or whatever your dreams were at that point. You must have stuck out a little bit growing up in a small town like that.
Yeah, well, what it was is they didn't have any sort of, they'd never seen anything like me, really, in some ways, in that I was this young 12, 13-year-old kid that was writing songs and singing and able to perform God Bless the USA. And
like, where did that come from? Like, I was playing guitar when I was 11, but I never thought about writing songs or anything like that. And I was terrified to go play out in public.
It was really weird. I was born to be some sort of writer. I have a natural tendency to imagine stuff, you know.
Right.
And I think there's a couple of my kids like that.
Right.
Like, they don't want to learn arithmetic or spelling in any way, but they are obsessed with stories.
Isn't one of your kids named after Huck Finn?
Yes, did that. My hero, my philosophical hero is Mark Twain. I just think there's never been a brighter American.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm actually reading Tom Sawyer right now for the first time.
Have you read Huck Finn?
No. Got them both.
That's the great American novel.
I don't know that yet, but I know that I'm supposed to know that. So I'm going to get to it.
And I as a kid that probably had adventures, you'll get it. And what's amazing, it's a total dissertation on the evils of slavery disguised as the adventures of an incredibly free-spirited boy. It's amazing. And the thing to remember when you read Huck Finn is he wrote this book at a time when the world had never seen anything like it, where he writes it with complete and total in the jargon of this boy. Like, he spells a word the way it would have been said, as opposed to the proper spelling.
Right, sure.
Or something. And everybody thought, I mean, it was an okay, it wasn't the hugest hit at the time, but as time went by, before the end of his life, everybody was saying, this is the best thing ever been done.
Right.
And but anyway, I grew up and I kind of thinking that way. And when I was 12, I wrote a song. And for some reason, I wrote this Christmas song that that's actually, I look back at it, it's pretty good. It's like, it, I've written worse songs, you know.
Since then.
Lately, yeah. And I wrote this thing called Born on Christmas Day, and it was just, I don't know what it was, but I sat down and I thought, what would it be like to write a song about this? And, like, it actually has some really weirdly wise things in it that for 12 years old, like, there's the bridge is, we expected a soldier to save us from our plight, dressed in shiny armor, ready for a fight. Instead, he sent a little baby boy.
Huh.
And it's like, that's 12.
Pretty heavy for a 12-year-old,
yeah,
it's
like
a
12-year-old, and I wrote every word of it. And,
right.
And I know I did. I'm the only one that knows, because I went up to my room and came down, and my mom and dad were there, and they said, what have you been doing? I said, I wrote a song.
And were you hooked at that point? Like, did you just start writing it? Like, where were you in your guitar playing? Were you, like, a child prodigy, or...
No, like, no, I was nowhere near a prodigy.
Like, how did you pick up the guitar in the first place, and where did you learn to play the way that you do?
I played because I loved, like, that was, I had a grandpa that was the main influence of my life. I credit him with everything I have, everything I've become. He loved country music, and when he was in his 50s, he decided to learn to play the guitar because he was a radio dispatcher, telegrapher on the B&O Railroad. Mm. So he sat in one of those buildings, you know, where the trains come through, and did all the Morse code.
Right.
Because that's the trait he learned in World War II. So when he got back from World War II, a lot of people basically took jobs doing whatever it was they learned how to do. And he learned Morse code over there, so he was working for the railroad, and he did that his whole life. And a lot of long hours, because you had to imagine, freight train comes through at, what, you know, 3 p.m. There's not another one till 6 or 5 or something. There's 2 hours in between.
Right.
So he bought an old Yamaha acoustic and nice. Decided he was going to learn to play it. And the next thing you know, there he is. He's playing Wildwood Flower and Under the Double Eagle and crazy stuff like that. Like, his hero was Chet Atkins, and he loved Buck Owens, and he loved any country that was instrumentally based, like,
right.
Johnny Cash, Buck Owens, Merle right. Haggard. Those were the records that I grew up listening to.
Because of him.
All right. The twang, all that stuff. Because sure. It was like...
you hear that in your music.
Yeah, you know, I'm always playing a telly. I'm always sort of finding ways to throw in a twangy lick if I can, if it fits the song. And I'm also heavily influenced by other genres, but there's this core that comes back to Don Rich and all that, and
right.
Because of my grandpa, and so he, you know, for me, it was about learning this type of music, and I wasn't great but by the time I was 13 or 14, I could play something like Freight Train, which is the thumb style, like Merle
right.
Travis picking. I remember sitting on the porch with a guitar. And doing that dun, 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 on the bass,
sure.
and trying to keep it going with the da, 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 while you're doing the bass line with your thumb, and it was mind numbing. I think I did that for weeks, and one day it clicked, like
right.
how you do it, and I figured it out, and I ran down to his house, and I think he teared up that I could, because he had
really?
He had never been able to learn that,
yeah,
And that's where sort of the country influence took hold. Was I was this crazy geeky kid that in junior high, imagine these kids are starting to listen to in the 80s. I mean, you know, they're into Van Halen and
sure,
which Mike I loved
and whatever. And
all that. Yeah, I loved all that and learned Hot for Teacher eventually, because at some point you're like, okay, I have to show them I can do this too. But it's like you do this stuff and then. And I'm playing like Cannonball Rag.
Right.
You don't get a girl with
which
Cannonball
isn't even
Rag.
Like current country at that point.
No,
I mean,
it's
like
been,
already
it's Merle
super
Travis.
Retro.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Like
yeah.
It's prior to Chet Atkins. It's
yeah.
not even.
Yeah, that's wild.
And they hadn't heard of Chet Atkins.
And so, was there like a local guy? I mean, besides your grandpa, that you studied with? Like, because it's you mm-hmm. know, there's so much in your playing that
there was a guy.
I can't imagine. Like, what else were you listening? Jazz and.
Yeah, oh
just
yeah.
Everything.
Well,
were you just sponging it up.
My main teacher guy was his hero was a guy named Hank Goddard, and he was only called Hank because he sounded like Hank Garland. And so Hank Garland was one of the greatest country players of all time. I mean, right. He could do, I don't know if you've ever heard Jazz Winds in a Different Direction or in a New Direction, but it is an album Hank Garland made that's jazz. He could destroy anybody playing up there in New York at a jazz club. He was crazy great. And then he ended up in a car accident. Sort of like, there was too many stories like this back in the day where you had Don Rich killed on a motorcycle. They had this guy that was in a car accident and he lost his ability to play. And there's a great story in Nashville. There's a bunch of stories where all the session musicians would go in and write his name on the card, even.
Oh, like, really?
After it's like he's got credit on songs he didn't play on because they were trying to get him paid after that car accident.
Because they just loved and respected this guy.
And they couldn't. And it was such a tragedy that he couldn't play anymore. But it's guys like that. So Hank that taught me was he could do. I mean, any Les Paul song, anything by he could play Tal Farlow. He could do. I mean,
the story goes like a lot of the early country recordings. Mm-hmm. A lot of the session cats on those sessions were really jazz guys.
Some of them,
that were playing just what was popular at the time.
Yeah, you had some of those like Hank Garland and guys like I'm trying to think of who the others would be. Then you had guys like Reggie Young that eventually started to play a lot of the stuff you heard in the 70s and 80s that really came from like Muscle Shoals that had the blues thing that started to bring that to it. But that's always been the case in country, is it's not necessarily somebody that comes from a purely country background that does the most interesting stuff.
Right.
It's these people that come in, and I've always said jazz, country is just jazz on the back pickup. It's just like you go, like that. You go to your neck pickup and play the same lick.
Yeah.
Go to your back pickup and it's all of a sudden.
Well, so much of guitar playing, I feel like, is like, it's context.
Yeah,
it's what's the rest of the band doing. You know, it's like you play an Angus Young solo over Gene Vincent and it's going to sound rockabilly. You know what I mean? It's like it's sort of got to be in context of what's happening.
Absolutely. As well as the fact that you realize the importance of the song quickly, because otherwise you're a guitar center.
Right.
It's just people doing pentatonic licks at guitar center.
Yeah.
A great pentatonic lick can sound great when you got them in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but when there's nothing going on, but can I help you, sir? And you hear, no, I got this.
That's a funny thing, you know, like, and I was going to ask you about this, because I don't know if there's a parallel in country music, but in rock music, after the 80s, lead guitar playing became kind of a shameful. Like, it was not allowed for a long time.
I don't understand that. I know. And it bums me out because it's like, I love everything about grunge except that it was sort of like you can't.
Right.
You know, because I love what happened to rock with grunge. It's like, finally, there was, it was sort of taken away. You were taken off the sheen, and it was time to just say, screw this.
It's like that periodic thing of, well, we got to strip this down. And
totally. It got rid of, it's sort of, the wax is building up again.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, you're about to see another shift, I think.
Yeah,
Because rock has not figured, one of the things that country is going for right now is rock has not figured itself out at all. The only guys left are you guys. And it's like, you know what I'm saying? You're semi-alone on the airwaves, you know.
I think a lot of that has to do with the business, the music industry, the business side of it, because I just think it's so much harder now.
And
bands to get to that level where they can make three or four or five albums and really develop into something. I don't know how young bands do it.
As well as there's a lot of toys that people are infatuated with right now. You know, the loops and the synths and the bass drops and things that are fun to throw in your songs. And it's like, but we'll see what happens. But that was the thing that I did love about the 80s and 90s was when there were still hair bands, was that you could guarantee, there was the guaranteed guitar solo.
Right.
There was no song without a guitar solo.
Right.
Not one. I mean, you can't name a Van Halen song that doesn't, he doesn't take a break.
Oh, yeah, I don't think that ever.
And I'm kind of that way on my records. It's really hard for me to not throw a solo in something. Even ballads, it's like, well, where's this little channel piece that I can play like something?
I wanted to ask you about that because I was wondering if there was a time when you were first, when you first got your record deal and were first making records, working with like a, pro producer and, had your A&R guy.
My producer, I've never worked with a pro producer.
Well, I know that they
always worked, they are now, but we didn't, we weren't together. Yeah.
Well, I was I guess my question is, I was wondering if there was a time early on in your career where the industry tried to say, well, you know, Brad, you can't play a guitar solo all over the place. That's not how we do it. You know, you got to fit it more into this thing. But I was listening in preparation for this. I was listening to some of your first record.
Yeah.
And it's
it was very
there.
Country out. Yeah, a lot of guitar.
Yeah, a lot of guitar. I mean, it was there from the beginning.
They sort of chose to release ballads right off the bat on me because it was much more palatable. And it hid. One thing that one of my record label presidents at the time said was, you know, let's not talk about the fact that you played the guitars, because the only guitar player on my first album is me. There's nobody else.
Right.
And I did that sort of on purpose. First of all, I didn't have another guitar player in the band yet. It was me and a drummer and a fiddle player and a bass player at that time. And, that were really the core members. And then we used session players in addition to them. And for me, it was like, okay, what do we do here as far as, like, marketing this guy? And they're like, well, let's just talk about you as a songwriter singer. That way, it's sort of like, he just felt like the simpler message is, you know, he's like, people will figure out that you're playing the guitar, because the first time they see you live, they're going to see you do that.
Right.
He's like, it's not like people are going to buy your record just because you play the guitar. They don't think that way.
Right.
In popular music necessarily, you know. And so he said, let's just try to get you some hits on the radio. And I was trusting him with that, and we did that, and we got a couple of hits, and then eventually I started to have hits that had actual solos in them.
Right.
And then it was for me. Then it became fun, because by the third record, the first two albums were largely written prior to getting a record deal.
Right.
Most of those songs I had from when I was a staff writer at EMI, so I was like, I had written them. And I knew what they were going to... I mean, I had, you know, 8/10 of the second album was older than the first.
Huh.
Which was so funny to every now and then read a review. It's like, well, he's really honing his craft as a songwriter. Like, no, these are the early
ones. You
got
it in reverse.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And so by the third record, there was nothing that existed on that album that was any older, that was not sort of more new. And conversely, I was like, you know, I could get away with a wah-wah pedal on this. And the first two records, it was sort of more like, what would Buck Owens do?
Sure.
And then the third record was like, okay, now I've established who I am, what can I get away with?
Is that when you put your foot down and like, hey, I'm going to record with my band?
No, they were always, it's interesting. I always used guys that were playing for me. My first album was... half of it was Eddie Bears, who's a great session player, and half of it was the guy that was playing for me at the time that I had played with in college. He ended up saying, look, I don't want to go on the road, so it ended up not being my band that played that, but originally he was. So I got a road drummer quickly that has been on every record since, and his name's Ben Caesar. He's Berkeley schooled. He's a crazy great drummer. He is my favorite drummer I've ever played with, by far.
Right.
And I've played with some great, you know, everybody. And I love Arnov, and I love all these guys that I play with from time to time on other things. But
did I read that he also shapes your hats or something?
No, my piano player does that.
Oh, okay. I got that.
I shape my own hat, but I taught my piano player to do it so that somebody else can do it.
Did he get a raise?
Yeah.
I'm gonna pay you a little extra, and you're going to shape my hat.
This year he got a raise, but I don't know if it was for the hat shaping.
But, that's funny.
Yeah, he can actually shape one when I'm in a hurry, you know, because I throw one away every night. But my drummer was the best find, and he was wanting to play sessions too, you know, and so he ate it alive. I firmly believe that any musician that's going to play this on a nightly basis is going to do a better job in the studio.
Right.
Now, they may not be up to caliber, and in that case, they shouldn't be on the road anyway, but I love when guys bring in their road band to play something.
Right.
And
but that's still kind of unusual, isn't it, in Nashville?
Very. Yeah, unfortunately, very unusual. And I, you know, I'm lucky, though. I got a fiddle player that can go toe-to-toe with anybody. I got the best steel player, best for his age group in town. I mean, my guy, anybody will tell you that Randall Curry that plays my records he's hard to beat. I mean,
right.
He is.
Right.
You can't paint him in a corner.
That is not an easy instrument to.
That's like a person that should work at CERN.
I played with a pedal steel player one time that played a whole song. We were playing a gig.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never played with him before. This was in the very early days of my Dead Peasants thing. And he played a whole song a half step off.
Wow.
It was the and he held it there. Like, he never pushed it.
He didn't
it
know?
He didn't know. and I didn't figure it out until afterwards. It just, while it was going on, I was just like, what is happening right now?
Yeah.
This is crazy. That's one of those instruments, like, it really, like, you either play it well or you can't play that thing at all.
There are some people that can't stand a great steel guitar. I love great steel guitar. You give me a great steel guitar and it's you know, heavenly, but... there's nothing worse. There's
nothing tugs at the heartstrings like a good pedal steel.
But there's nothing more annoying than a bad fiddle or a bad steel guitar. Yeah. A bad fiddle too. I mean, you've heard bad
for the same reason. No frets. It's very unforgiving.
And it screeches too. I mean, you do one little. I mean, I tried to play the fiddle for about 2 weeks. Somebody gave me one and said, "Hey, I made you a fiddle," and it was like I finally gave it back and said, "You need to give this to somebody that has an ability for this, because this is horrifying."
I own a banjo. I don't say I play the banjo, mm-hmm. but I own one, and I take it out about once a year and go, this is going to be the time. I'm going to figure this thing out. And
it's
all it does is upset.
It just
upsets my house.
It's such a
my family just gets
mindset.
Mad.
No, it's bad, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like there's incest happening in your house when you play.
Totally. You know? It's tough. Let's go. I wanted to ask you about some of your early stuff. Did you, I don't know what was the name of it, Jamboree USA.
Yeah.
Was that something that was back when you were at home, right? So that when you were a kid? Was that before college?
It was when I was, when I was 13, I was asked to be on that, and because of songwriting. I wrote that Christmas song, and I played it at something, and the program director was there and invited me on. I flipped out. I couldn't believe I was going to get to play on this.
Is it like a Grand Ole Opry kind
of? Yeah, it's like that, but done differently. The Opry is, you know, a parade of people, because it's in Nashville and you can get people to show up. It's a parade all night of just everybody from Bill Anderson and Jimmy Dickens, Jeannie Seely and Gene Shepherd and whoever else, and then some, you know, Carrie Underwood and whoever else is that's new.
Mm-hmm.
But in Wheeling, they would have a headliner come in, and it was in this great old Victorian theater called the Capitol Music Hall, and it was, you know, it might be 1 week was Roy Clark and the next week was Ray Price, and the next week was Charlie Pride, and the next week was Steve Warner, and the next week was Vince Gill. And
did you get to meet all those
folks? I opened for them all.
Really?
I got to meet all of them, and I got to play.
They're just like, who's this cute little boy? Like, how old were you at that point?
I was 13 when I started, but when I really started playing for them, I was probably 15 through 20.
Right.
I moved when I was 20 to Nashville. So I had about 7 years of playing that show, and picking people's brains and getting to know really well. A guy like Steve Warner was great help. Charlie Pride took a huge interest in me. I mean, he was notoriously good to new singers, and
right.
he thought I was neat, you know. And I, you know, again, I wasn't a prodigy. I sang okay. I played okay. You know, my dad used to say this. He was like, "You're really great for 15." And he was very honest. He'd say, "You're," and he had no musical ability whatsoever.
Right.
He'd say, "You're great for 15, and you're cute."
And that counts for a lot.
And you're going to be 20. And at the same level at 20, you're not as cute, and you're not very good.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I used to take that very seriously. It made me mad, but...
Sure.
He was
probably inspired you to
absolutely
work your ass off.
It's like, be better than you ought to be.
Right.
At all ages.
Well, that's interesting. So you did all this before college, and then you went to college and then moved to Nashville. Am I getting the timeline right?
Yeah. So I went to 2 years of college up there at West Liberty State University up there, which is like a total just regular college. A lot more of a party school than where I wound up.
Were you playing in bands all through that mm-hmm. time?
Yeah, I did Battle of the Bands and things like that there. Yeah. And I was constantly busy in my hometown. I'd become the biggest fish in a very small place.
Right.
In a town of 1,200 people, when you want to be a star, they'll make you a star, relatively speaking.
Right, right, right.
It's like, I want to sing. Great. We got a Lions Club dinner.
Yeah, come on
and
down.
And we'll feed you.
Yeah.
And give you $100 if you'll come down and bring your PA system and sing a couple songs.
Hey, that's a good gig, man, when you're starting out.
Especially when you're 13 years old.
Sure.
And you're getting $100.
Oh, yeah.
That's a Lego and a half. You know,
totally.
It's anything you want, you know.
I remember when the first time I played a bar, Yeah. I was 16. And up until that point, I played a lot of parties, mm-hmm. you know, keg parties and that sort of yeah. thing. And, like, you know, played in the quad of our high school. And the first time I played a bar, we played, and none of our friends could get into the bar.
Yeah.
You know, they were all standing out by the door.
Yeah.
And I walked over, and I sat down at the bar, and the bartender just popped open a long neck, sat down on the bar. And I was like, oh, what?
Yeah.
And I drank it.
What town was this?
This was where I grew up, in Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara?
Yeah. And so put it back
what
on.
What bar?
I don't remember the name. It was a bar out, I want to say it was out in Goleta, and they used to have gigs there. And
is it still
can't
there?
That's possibly that's... still. But I'll ask my buddy Luke that plays guitar with me.
Okay.
Dead Peasants was in the band.
Okay.
At the time. So I finished my beer and I stuck it down. The guy took the empty, opened up another one. I was just like, dude, this is the life. This
yeah,
is the greatest
yeah, no
thing
kidding.
Ever, man.
Now that guy's in jail.
totally.
That's the thing about, I was doing that too. I mean, I was just like you that way. I was playing bars with men much older than me in the band. And,
yeah.
But I was always sort of, I was never given the free beer. I was always sort of, they were always very careful sort of yeah. with me, but I didn't care. I didn't even care about that.
Yeah,
I wasn't
yeah.
the least bit interested in drinking at all. And I was there to play, and
right.
I wanted to play music. And that's why we were talking about this earlier. I built a bar in the studio house I was telling you about.
Right.
That's where this pub is. And I basically took this guy, this old redneck from Georgia that does all this woodworking for me, and contractor guy. And he had never been outside of like the southeastern United States. I mean, Georgia, Tennessee, it's about the limit. And I'm like, I want you to build me a pub. And I say a pub, I don't mean like, you know, a bad sports bar. I'm talking about an Irish pub.
Proper.
He's like, well, what do those look like? And I said, well, we're playing Dublin in the spring. Come with me.
Right.
So we flew him to Dublin with us on tour. And he had already begun the bar and begun the room. He'd looked at photos, and he was cutting all this hand-cut maple and putting
yeah,
it on the
yeah.
walls and building. And so he went over there with us, which was mind-blowing. So we built this four-tap, you know, with all these rare whiskeys and bourbons and things in it, and it's got cigar ventilation. And we built this in the studio house, which changed this entire new record. But what it is in the mornings, like, we will get together. The buses leave from my farm, too. So
uh-huh.
the guys in the band will come over on it. If we're leaving at midnight. For, like, last 2 weeks ago, we had a gig in Illinois, so we were leaving on a Friday at midnight. And they all showed up at about 11, and I started just pouring them drinks because
mm-hmm.
they're just getting on the bus.
Right.
And we smoked cigars, stayed there, and then the next morning, it's that while you were recording and you would do that, you would get up, and I'd go down there to start recording the next day, and it had that exact thing that I would, when I would go back and get my amp on a Sunday after playing till 2 a.m. on a Saturday night, it was like, I don't know what it is, but you know how smell jogs your memory.
Oh, yeah.
And for me, it was that way. It's like I walk in the studio now, and it feels like my childhood
right.
to me.
Right, right. Well, that's a funny thing that... that is lost on people now because you're not allowed to smoke anywhere.
I know the smoke. Yeah, exactly.
I never really smoked. You know, I kind of party smoked here and there, but I was never a smoker. But when you hung out in a bar or a club,
yeah.
and then went home and like threw your clothes on the floor and got into bed and then woke up the next day and put those same clothes back on, there was like a funk on those clothes.
Oh yeah,
that nightclub funk that was just yeah. smoke and spilled beer and whiskey.
And think about the way that guitars look. Because of that.
Yeah.
Like the way that instruments age.
How they're all yellow.
They're all yellow.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is that going to happen now?
I don't know. Because it's
what I mean?
All yellow. It's not the same finish anymore.
Will a Pacific White Strat still be yellow in 20 years? Or will it be white now?
Yeah.
You know
I don't know. It's got to affect it.
You know? I bet it does. It's
yeah.
a different thing. I'm sure it's probably for the best.
Right.
But,
hopefully, maybe it'll still be white, but we won't all die of lung cancer.
Yeah, that'd be good.
There's
pros and cons to it.
Yeah. So you were talking about going to Europe and playing in Dublin. You you have a sizable following overseas, which
somehow
is, it's unusual for an American country artist.
Very,
right?
But maybe we've broken the ground and it's going to happen more.
Well, was that? Did you set out to do that? Was
nope.
that like a goal, or did that just happen?
Well, what happened was, I started getting into. I love British rock.
Right. Sure.
I just think they, you know, in so many ways, they. I don't know what it is about that island, but they, and same with Ireland, but it's like they look at us and then they go, oh, okay. It's sort of like with comedy. They like look at the comedy from America and then they create Monty Python.
Right.
Or they, you know, it's like the Beatles are looking at they would look at, like, you know, guys
Little
like
Richard or
Little
something.
Richard or yeah or Chuck Berry and the next Buddy thing you know Holly. And then next thing you know they're doing Strawberry Fields and
right.
somehow that became that and,
sure
and it's sort of the case too with a lot of these modern British bands are so cool
to, right.
you know like I don't know if you've heard of bands called like A Silent Film or
I don't know
they're really neat they're obscure but I started sort of listening to a lot of that stuff
right.
you know I feel like the Killers feel British and they're not which
right.
is kind of the reverse of this but it's like you go and I started to realize, well, there's this, you know, they're also in some ways the most pioneering recording, you know, a lot of these desks that we like are
oh,
British,
sure.
you know,
yeah,
when you think
yeah.
about SSLs. And so I took the Norway gig the first time. This has been years ago now. And we went over and did that. And I said, while I'm on my way, just book us in Europe. They're like, well, okay, you won't sell it out, but we'll put you in a little club that everybody plays. You guys have probably done this, the Shepherd's Bush.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and they're like, everybody plays it. You know, so-and-so went over, and they're naming some big country act. They're like, he went over, and he doesn't, you know, it's 2,000 seats. You'll sell 1,000.
Right.
But it'll be fun, and
yeah.
you're in Britain. And
yeah, just enjoy it.
So I go, and they put it on sale. And what it was is I had waited. I had gone over and played my first year, and then didn't go back because it was such a nightmare experience as far as the travel went. Because I was, you know, it was brand new. Everything was in steerage. Everything was behind, you know, all the instruments that we could get, we had to basically check, and rental gear.
Right.
It was a
right.
nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
So this time I was like, well, we're shipping it all over. We're going to do this right. If I'm going to do it, we're going to take our stuff. I'm going to use my amps. I'm going to use, you know,
right.
I want everything right. And so we put it on sale, and it sold out that day.
Really?
So I put another night on sale. Sold out again. They said, we could have sold 4 of these out. So it's like, okay, so let's go. So we do that, and it's insane. They know the words to songs off the first album. I could have played any album cut. You know how it is. They're so absolutely 100% committed because they had to choose to be country fans over there. They weren't
right.
raised on it.
Right, right.
Anybody that's a fan is like...
And it's exotic.
Yeah, I'm the farthest thing from exotic in America, but over there I'm like,
right.
look at this guy in this cowboy hat.
Yeah.
What is that?
He's so real.
Yeah. He's a cowboy.
Yeah.
They're wearing like chaps and holsters over there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're dressed like they think they ought to be. And they think I'm going to ride in on a horse.
Right, right.
So they, you know,
should have.
That would have, yeah, they would have been like, absolutely.
Yeah, perfect.
Yep, perfect.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, it's funny, man, the crowds over there, and those are really the craziest crowds in the world that I've ever experienced.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is back in the day, back when like, a lot of the other artists in country would attempt to go over. Like Buck Owens played there. He did a Live in London album that's great. But I've heard people complain about the crowds at one time. They just said they're too subdued. They were too proper and all this stuff. I think Bill Monroe might have felt that way or whatever, whoever went over there. But it's like that's changed.
Oh, yeah.
Because
no,
I mean,
like, it's like soccer hooligans going crazy, singing along with everything.
I know. And, you know, I think it's yet another example of they took what we do and said, here's how we'll do it. And they
right.
just jump.
Right.
And it's like, we're going to jump to the beat.
Right.
And, you know, it was really interesting because one of the greatest experiences that I've ever had was this last time when we played the O2. We sold, it was a big festival that we did, but we headlined the night and it sold out 18,000 tickets. So we're playing and I'm last. And it was, and they released a song of mine called The Mona Lisa, over there on BBC Two, and it was a hit. It actually, because it's kind of a, it's sort of done like an old Stones tune or something, but it's got a big refrain, whoa, this whole thing. And so I ended with that because it was currently a hit in England at the time. So I'm playing this song and we end and I'm like, good night. And I walk off before the encore and they do the thing that they do so well, where they just kept doing it. And they
right.
just kept singing the woes.
Yeah, yeah.
They chant. I mean, I let them go for like a minute and a half, and then I walked back out, and the drummer just started back in, you
right.
know, to the same exact beat. Did that, and then I did the song Alcohol, which I always end with in the encore, and ended again, and that was the end. Said goodnight, walked off, and they broke back into the woes again in Mona Lisa.
Really?
The whole arena. And
so they were paying attention.
I just stood backstage and listened again. And so then I found out that all the way home on the tube, you know how they all take the tube to the O2. that they were the whole tube was singing that all the way back, which they said the next time you play here, you need to take the tube after the concert and just sit and listen to them do it and be a part of it, which would be an amazing like video to make or something.
Oh yeah,
but yeah, I love that aspect of it, and I think that the only I kind of lucked out, and what I found was the internet's changed everything. Because we still don't have any airplay over there. They're not going to play a country record because they don't have a country station.
Right.
I've had a couple of hits now over there, but the thing is that you don't. I mean, it's the internet. You can get any. It's the great equalizer.
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways, and in other ways, it's the great Satan.
Yeah, Luke, part one of my interview with Brad Paisley. How cool was that guy?
That very cool. That was a tasty podcast.
Tasty podcast. I feel like I learned a lot. Like, don't you, after you listen to that, don't you want to go to your Spotify or Beats or whatever and like look up Hank Garland songs and like try to figure out how to play them?
Or just quit.
Exactly. I give up. Thank you, Brad Paisley. So yeah, 2 weeks from today, we will put up the next section, part two, the end climax of the Brad Paisley interview, where he's going to talk about sexy things like gear and amps and the music business. So be sure to stay tuned back in for that one. That's a ladies-only podcast, bro. All right, this is Chris Shiplett and Luke Tierney signing off for the week.
See you later.
Adios, amigos. Tell our bosses they can do the same. We'll find a big cruise ship and buy the whole dang thing. We sail around.